I want you to try a little thought experiment with me to kick things off today.
Okay, I'm game.
Imagine you are an engineer, or, maybe a god, and you are trying to design an intelligent life form completely from scratch.
Right.
You want something smart, something capable of solving puzzles, navigating mazes, maybe even using tools.
So pretty standard sci-fi stuff so far.
Yeah, but here are the constraints. You cannot use a skeleton.
No skeleton at all.
None. No bones, no rigid internal structure to anchor the muscles against. And you have to distribute the brain. So it's not just sitting in a head, it's scattered throughout the body.
Okay.
And just to make it really, really hard on yourself, you have to give this creature eight limbs that can move in literally any direction.
Oh, man.
Lengthen, shorten, twist, curl, all independently of each other.
I mean, if you pitch that to a robotics lab today, they would literally laugh you out of the room. The computing power required to control that many, what's called degrees of freedom, without the whole thing just ending up in a tangled knot. It's a logistical nightmare.
It is, and yet nature didn't just solve this problem. It solved it hundreds of millions of years ago.
Yeah, really did.
So today on the Deep Dive, we aren't just talking about the common octopus, the Octopus vulgaris, as it, a master of camouflage,
Which it is.
which it absolutely is. But today we are looking at it as a biological alien, a creature that evolved complex intelligence on a completely different evolutionary track than we did.
It really is like the plan B for intelligence on Earth. I mean, if vertebrates like us are the standard
The
model,
central brain, the spinal cord.
exactly, the skeleton, if that's the standard, the octopus is the alternative blueprint. It achieved the exact same results, like high-level cognition and problem-solving, but it used completely different parts to get there.
And to understand those parts, we have a really serious stack of research
We
today.
do.
First up, we're looking at a massive PhD thesis from 2024 by Federica Pizzoli from the Open University. It's titled The Brain of Octopus Vulgaris, and it is essentially the wiring diagram for the octopus mind.
And it is incredibly dense. I mean, Pizzoli used something called graph theory to map out the connectome,
The connectome, right.
basically tracing how the different regions of the brain physically talk to each other.
But because we can't ignore those eight legs, we are pairing that thesis with a breaking news release from the University of Chicago. This is hot off the presses from January 2025.
Yeah, and this study ignores the head entirely. They look strictly at the nervous system inside the arms to figure out how they actually work.
So we have the central command, the brain, and the field agents, the arms.
Exactly.
Our mission for this deep dive is to figure out how a bag of water thinks. How does an animal with no bones and a distributed mind make decisions? And I want to start with a number from the Pizzoli thesis that honestly, it's talked to me.
The neuron count.
Yes. The octopus brain has about 200 million neural cells.
Which is just a staggering number for an invertebrate.
Well, put that in context for me, because when I think of invertebrates, I'm thinking of like clams or snails, maybe a worm.
Right.
And they have what, a few thousand neurons?
Usually tens of thousands, maybe, but 200 million, that puts the octopus in the same league as many small mammals.
Really?
Yeah, it's comparable to a dog or a small primate in terms of raw neural count.
Wow.
And that tells us immediately that this animal isn't just operating on basic reflexes. That much hardware is expensive to maintain biologically.
You have to feed it.
Exactly. You only evolve that many neurons if you actively need the processing power for memory, learning, and complex decision-making.
But unlike a dog, those neurons aren't all packed into a skull.
No, they are distributed.
Oh.
But, and this is where it gets interesting, the thesis focuses heavily on the central brain, which is fascinating because it actually is wrapped in a cartilaginous cranium.
Which is weird, right? Mollusks don't usually have skulls.
Not at all. It shows how specialized this organ is. And inside that cartilage, the brain is fused into these distinct masses. You have the supraesophageal mass and the subesophageal mass.
Which, if I'm reading my Latin right, just means the brain above the throat and the brain below the throat.
Pretty much. Esophagus literally runs right through the middle of their brain.
That is wild. Every time they swallow a crab, it passes through their brain.
It does. But flanking these masses are the real stars of the show, the optic lobes.
Yeah, the thesis made a huge deal about the size of these.
They are massive. The optic lobes take up about 45% of the total brain volume.
That's almost half.
Right. If you look at just the centralized nervous system, two-thirds of it is dedicated purely to vision.
Two-thirds. That seems completely excessive just to see where you're going. I mean, humans are visual creatures, right? But our visual cortex isn't two-thirds of our brain.
Exactly. And it implies that the octopus is what we'd call a visual capitalist. It is processing an immense amount of data,
Like what?
high-definition details, polarized light, textures, complex patterns, and it's doing the heavy computational lifting right there behind the eyes.
So they don't have to send it to the central processor.
Right. It suggests their intelligence is primarily driven by analyzing their visual environment.
Okay, so we have this hardware, a brain split by a throat, giant visual processors, and 200 million neurons. But a bucket of parts isn't a machine.
No, you have to wire it up.
And this is where the Pazzulli thesis gets really heavy into graph theory. Now, I usually associate graph theory with analyzing like social networks or airport hubs. How does it apply to a squid cousin?
It's the exact same principle. You treat the brain regions as nodes and the nerves connecting them as edges.
Okay.
You want to see how information flows. Is it a random mess? Is it a rigid line? And the analysis found that the octopus brain follows a small world architecture.
Small world, like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing?
Conceptually, yes.
Yeah.
A small world network has two specific characteristics. First, high clustering. Imagine a neighborhood where everyone knows everyone.
Okay, so lots of local chatter.
Right. That's great for local processing, handling a specific task very quickly. But secondly, it has short path lengths.
Meaning you can get a message from one side of the brain to the other without going through a million stops.
Precisely. It balances being thorough with being incredibly fast. The thesis suggests this network achieves high global efficiency while only using about 25% of the total possible connections.
So it's not just plugging everything into everything else.
No, it's optimized. It's getting the maximum computing power for the lowest biological cost.
And this efficiency leads to what I think is easily the coolest term in the whole document, the rich club.
Oh, the Rich Club is a very big deal in neuroscience.
I love it. It sounds like an exclusive VIP lounge where the neurons just sit around sipping expensive champagne.
Functionally, that's really not far off. The Rich Club phenomenon refers to a specific group of high-degree hubs that are densely interconnected with each other.
The power players.
Exactly. They're the power players. In the octopus, this club includes the optic lobe, the subvertical lobe, and the medial basal lobe.
Along with the pre- and postbrachial lobes, right?
Yes, exactly.
So instead of passing a message through a dozen small local neurons, the brain sends it to the rich club and they broadcast it out to the rest of the system.
That is the mechanism. It creates a central backbone for global communication. But here's the big so what of this whole thing.
Okay.
We see this exact same rich club architecture in mammalian brains.
Really?
Yes, cats have it, macaques have it, humans have it.
But hold on, we haven't shared a common ancestor with an octopus for, what, 600 million years?
Right, 600 million. This is convergent evolution at its absolute finest. It tells us that there is likely only one best way to build a complex, high-functioning brain.
So whether you're a vertebrate walking on land or a squishy mollusk in the ocean.
If you want to be smart, the math dictates you have to build a rich club.
That is wild. It's like finding out that an alien civilization independently invented the internet, and it uses the exact same routing protocols that we do.
Because it's just the most efficient way to move data.
Exactly.
That's a perfect analogy. The thesis even identifies specific wiring patterns called Motif 9.
Motif 9, yeah, I saw that.
They're little loops of three neurons that look suspiciously like the patterns we find in the mammalian cortex. It allows for a balance of segregation, doing specific jobs, and integration, putting it all together.
So the hardware is top tier. It's efficient, it's structured, it's surprisingly familiar to us. But hardware is just dead metal or, dead meat without software.
You need the chemicals.
Right. A brain isn't just wires, it's feelings, moods, drives. And the thesis spends a lot of time on what it calls the neuromodulatory fingerprint.
The chemical software. These are the molecules that change the state of the neural network.
And I was really surprised to see how much of this cast of characters I recognized. Serotonin, for example.
Well, serotonin is ancient. In the octopus, just like in us, it's found throughout the ganglia. It's linked to learning, but also to feeding and locomotion. It seems to be a universal regulator.
And dopamine, the reward chemical.
Dopamine is a big one. The thesis points out that in related mollusks, like the Limnaea pond, snail dopamine regulates hunger and satiety states.
Okay, so it tells the animal, I need food.
Right. I need food or I'm full.
Here.
It drives that motivation to go out and hunt or forage.
So an octopus on the prowl is likely riding a dopamine wave just like a wolf would be.
Very likely, yes. But here is where the alien nature kicks back in. We run on adrenaline, right?
Yeah.
If I get scared or I need to fight, I get a massive adrenaline dump. Does an octopus have adrenaline?
Given how you set that up, I'm guessing no.
No, they don't have the adrenaline or noradrenaline molecules at all.
So what do they use?
They use an invertebrate equivalent called octopamine.
Of course it's called octopamine.
It's perfect branding, isn't it? But along with another chemical called pyrimine, it functions as their fight or flight system.
So when an octopus flashes white and jets away in a panic in those nature documentaries.
That is octopamine flooding the system.
Fascinating. So they feel stress, or at least they have a physiological state that matches what we call stress.
They do. In fact, the thesis located these specific enzymes responsible for synthesizing these chemicals, things like tyrosine hydroxylase,
Okay.
and they found them in specific brain areas.
Yeah.
So yes, we can actually map the stress circuitry. They have high alert states. It's just mediated by a different chemical key.
And backing all this up is the genetics. The thesis mentions orphan genes, which honestly, it sounds a bit tragic.
It sounds sad, but it's actually a superpower. Orphan genes are genes that have no homologs, no matches in other species.
So they're unique to that specific lineage.
Exactly. And the octopus genome is absolutely full of them. Strikingly, about 18% of these orphan genes are neural specific.
Wait, so almost a fifth of the genetic instructions for building their brain are entirely unique to them. They didn't inherit them from an ancestor, they just wrote them.
Essentially, yes. This genetic toolkit allows for extreme plasticity. It lets them adapt their nervous system in ways other animals just can't.
That makes sense.
It's likely a big part of how they developed such complex intelligence so quickly in evolutionary time.
Okay, so let's pause and look at the picture so far. We have a central brain with a rich club architecture like a mammal. It's running on octopamine instead of adrenaline, and it's built with unique genetic code.
Right.
That explains the general and the command center. But the octopus is famous for its soldiers, the arms.
And this is where that new UChicago study comes in. Because the arms present a physics problem that should be completely unsolvable.
You're talking about the degrees of freedom problem.
Right. Think about your own arm. You have an elbow.
Yeah.
It can bend in one plane.
Right, up and down.
You have a wrist. It has a bit more movement. But you are ultimately limited by the bones. An octopus arm is what we call a muscular hydrostat.
Like a tongue.
Like a tongue or an elephant trunk. It can bend anywhere. It can twist, elongate, shorten, curl, all at the same time.
And there are eight of them. If the central brain had to consciously micromanage every single millimeter of muscle in eight arms simultaneously.
It would overheat. It's just too much data.
Exactly. So the UChicago team, this was led by Cassidy Olson and Clifton Ragsdale, they decided to look at the nervous system inside the arm.
And what they found completely overturns the textbook idea of how these arms work.
Which was what? That it was just one big nerve cable?
Yes. But they discovered that the nervous system in the arm is actually segmented.
Segmented, like an earthworm.
Very much like a worm. If you look at the axial nerve cord running down the center of the arm, it's not a smooth cable like a power line. Under the microscope, it looks like a corrugated pipe.
So it has ridges.
It has repeating structural units. The neuronal cell bodies are packed into these columns, the segments, and they're separated by gaps called septa.
And what happens at these gaps? What do the septa do?
That's where the nerves and blood vessels exit the cord to reach the muscles. This suggests that the arm isn't just one long continuous limb as far as the nervous system is concerned.
It's a series of local control centers strung together.
Precisely.
This makes so much sense for the movement. If the central brain says, hey, grab that crab, it doesn't need to calculate the physics of the reach. It just sends the high-level command, and the segments in the arm talk to each other to figure out the wave motion.
That's the implication, yeah. It allows for semi-autonomous movement. The arm handles the local complexity of how to move, which leaves the central brain free to think about strategy.
But the absolute coolest part of this study, for me at least, was the term they coined, succoroptopi.
It is a fantastic word, succoroptopi.
Please break down succoroptopi for us because I love it.
So in humans, we have somatotopy. It's a map of our body and our brain. You know, this specific part of the brain controls the thumb. This part controls the upper lip.
Right, the homunculus.
Exactly. Well, succoroptopi is a topographical map of the suckers.
Okay.
The researchers found that nerves connect systematically to the outer edge of each sucker. And you have to remember, suckers aren't just for gripping things. They are highly sensitive sensory organs.
Right, they can taste.
They have high-density taste and smell receptors right there on the rim, along with touch receptors.
It's like having a hand covered in hundreds of tiny tongues.
A hand covered in tongues and noses, yes.
That is a genuinely terrifying image.
It is a little gross, but think about the utility of it. This sucker octopi creates a precise sensory motor map.
Meaning
the octopus can taste a rock with the tip of its third arm. And thanks to this segmented wiring, the arm knows exactly where that taste is coming from in 3D space.
And it can manipulate the object immediately without asking the brain for permission.
Exactly. It's high-definition sensing combined with local motor control.
Wow.
And the study proved this wasn't just some evolutionary accident. They actually compared it to a squid, the longfin inshore squid specifically. Dorotoothus pili.
Right, because squid have tentacles too, so why would their wiring be any different?
Well, squid have 8 arms and 2 long tentacles, and the tentacles have a smooth stalk and then a club at the end where the suckers are.
Right, the club is what shoots out to grab the prey.
Exactly. The study found that the nerve cord in the smooth stalk is not segmented. It's just a smooth cable.
Okay.
But the nerve cord in the club, the part with the suckers, is segmented.
Oh, wow. That is the smoking gun right there.
It is. It tells us that evolution specifically builds this segmented, corrugated nervous system whenever it needs to control a dexterous, sucker-laden appendage. It's a dedicated design feature for fine motor control.
So if we pull all of this together from both sources, we're looking at a truly hybrid system.
We really are.
We have a central brain that uses a mammalian-style rich club network to make high-level decisions. Like, that is a crab. I want to eat it. Avoid the shark to the left.
That's central strategist.
Right. And then it delegates the execution of that strategy to 8 arms that are built like segmented worms. And those arms use sucker octopi to taste and feel the world in high definition, handling all the complex physics locally so the brain doesn't have to.
It really challenges the arrogance we sometimes have as vertebrates.
What do you mean?
Well, we tend to think our way, the spinal cord, the big cerebral cortex of the bones, is the only way to be smart.
Right. We think we're the absolute pinnacle of evolution.
But the octopus proves that you can achieve high-level complexity, small world networks, efficient hubs, complex learning, using a totally different biological toolkit.
Yeah.
You could do it with ganglia and octopamine and corrugated nerve cords. It's not a primitive version of a brain. It's just a different version.
It's the Android to our iOS.
That's a great way to put it. It's a completely different architecture running very similar apps.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a thought, something to chew on after the episode. We spend a lot of time looking for intelligence in the stars.
We do.
We scan for radio waves. We look for techno signatures. But if we do ever meet intelligent life out there,
it probably won't look like us.
Exactly. We always picture the gray alien, which is basically just a human with a big head and no nose. But if we look at the odds and we look at how incredibly robust this invertebrate blueprint is right here in our own oceans,
intelligent alien life might look a lot more like an octopus.
Yeah.
Distributed, chemically distinct, segmented, thinking in ways we can barely even comprehend. Honestly, the Rich Club Network might be the only thing we end up having in common with them.
Which is a pretty humbling thought. We aren't the standard model of the universe. We're just one of the options.
Indeed, we are.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the alien mind right here on Earth. Stay curious, and we'll catch you on the next one.